Hello and welcome to your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill and this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday, December 14th, 2024. I do hope you're all well.
While shepherds watch the flocks by night, seated on the ground.
This will actually be the last news edition before Christmas, as our editors and distribution volunteers are planning on having a rest in the days leading up to 2025. However, Mark's quarterly magazine will be produced and sent out to you before Christmas Day to fill the gap. And Steve's News Extra will be posted out on the first Friday of the new year. The music this week is the lovely Sweet Bells by Agnes Fountain. It's a Yorkshire version of While Shepherds Watch Their Flocks by Night, and I always find it rather more charming played in this less formal way. This week, as always, we start with the news stories from the Hearts Advertiser. This will be followed by the radio listings and the audio-described TV listings. 10 Today is up next, our series of gentle exercise routines to help keep you moving at home. Then we have our Events This Week in History item, which will be followed by some famous birthdays. Sounds of Nature, provided to us by the Wildlife Sound Recording Society, is next, where we hear the unusual and highly atmospheric sounds of wild birds in New Zealand. Then we'll have a short interlude to hear one of my favourite Christmas songs called, well, The Christmas Song, written by Mel Torme and sung by your in-house folky, that's me. Following on from this will be two stories from the Hearts Life Archive. The first is about Wellin Film Studios, which became Brighton for the Balding Brothers' great film Brighton Rock, among many other movies of the 40s and 50s. Then we hear about Humphrey Repton, the influential landscape designer. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Liz, Jenny, Fiona, and Anne.
Good morning, hello, I'm Jenny, and my first article today is on the front of the Hearts Advertiser this week, and it is Chapel in Memory of Head Teacher. School launches fundraiser for plans. A St Albans school has launched a fundraiser in memory of its former head teacher, who passed away. Staff at Townsend Church of England School are delighted to announce a fundraising campaign in memory of former school head Mr Andrew Wellbeloved. The new campaign aims to establish an on-site school chapel that will serve as a multi-faith space for reflection and worship. An official opening is planned for May 2025, coinciding with the 50th anniversary of the school's presence at the High Oak site, with the school hoping to raise the funds to complete the project by the end of the academic year. Chapel plans include a beautifully adorned space with light wooden furniture, accessible to all members of the school community for reflection and worship. The project has already received contributions from various churches, the Diocese of St Albans, and an investment from the school itself. An old computer suite next to the library, which is no longer needed due to the introduction of iPads for all students and teaching staff, is set to be repurposed for the build this academic year. In 2024, Townsend received very positive Ofsted and Church Schools, SIAMS, inspection reports, acknowledging the school's progress. Head teacher Anthony Flack, appointed in September 2023, said, "All the students, staff and Townsend community are delighted with the outcomes of our two inspections. They pay tribute to our warm, welcoming and inclusive school where everyone is able to be themselves, developing academically, personally and spiritually, and going on to make a positive impact on their school and the wider world." The year also saw the passing of Mr. Wellbeloved in April. A service at St. Albans Cathedral in June celebrated his nearly 30 years of dedicated service to the school. In discussion with his family and close friends, it became clear that Mr. Wellbeloved had always felt a school chapel would be a welcome addition to the fabric of the school.
Hello, I'm Fiona.
Apprenticeship scheme helps Graham turn his life around. A formerly homeless man has been branded an inspiration after he lifted himself out of homelessness through an apprenticeship scheme that gave him a brighter future. Graham Hickford, 49, from St Albans, joined the Morgan Sindall Property Services, the MSPS scheme, in 2022, which allowed him to become a qualified multi-skilled engineer. After battling addiction during his teenage years, Graham found himself in Emmaus, Hertfordshire, a hostel supporting formerly homeless individuals, which was where he was introduced to the apprenticeship. Graham says, "What I like about MSPS is that they have given me a chance where most companies wouldn't have, given my background. MSPS gives people the opportunity to progress through providing a lot of training, which can really help you down the line. Emmaus supported me with housing and by allowing me to stay while I finished my apprenticeship. It gave me independence. I needed to step out on my own to become self-sufficient. Graham is now in full-time employment and is fully independent, with his resilience and determination being nothing short of remarkable." Helen Sheen, Head of Social Value at Morgan Sindall Property Services, said, "Graham's journey demonstrates the transforming potential of our special value initiatives. By providing opportunities like our apprenticeships programmes, we not only change individual lives, but also strengthen the communities we serve. We are incredibly proud of Graham's achievements and his inspiring story of resilience and determination. He is a valued member of our St Albans team. MSPS is committed to working with residents from diverse backgrounds, giving them the confidence and skills to achieve their ambitions." And this article is accompanied by a lovely photo of Graham and a few of the others from Emmaus and MSPS in the old medieval hall at Hatfield House.
Hi, this is Liz. My first recording today is entitled "Peddling Pizza Maker Celebrates." Over 8 years ago, one St Albans pizza lover swapped being a courier for cooking on his bicycle and has never looked back. Adam Atkins, 43, has become a pizza sensation in the city and on social media during his 8 years making the famous Italian dish. Currently, the chef has amassed over 127,000 followers on social media and a lucrative partnership with pizza oven maker Gosney, creating content including vlogs and how-to classes. The majority of these videos feature his hometown of St Albans, where he spins pizzas every Wednesday on the market from his especially made £58,000 Chevrolet van. He said, "I was a delivery driver and the company went into administration on Christmas Day and my first child was coming in August of the next year, so I asked myself, what do I do? I had no plan, there was no idea of what I wanted to do, but I did know I was quite good at cooking, especially pizza," he added.
Hello. I'm Anne, and my first article is entitled "Former Pub Landlord Awarded Nuclear Test Medal." A former St Albans police officer and pub landlord has been recognised for his nuclear test exploits over six decades on. Geoffrey Smith, 86, who grew up in and around the St Albans area, has been awarded the new nuclear test medal 67 years after the event. Geoffrey attended St Albans Grammar School, now Verulam School, and he joined the RAF 100 Squadron during his national service. In 1957, he was posted to Mallorringa, South Australia, to witness atomic bomb testing. My colleagues and I were instructed to turn their backs at the moment of detonation. We were so close to the explosion that our clothes were blown off and it burnt our skin, he said. Unfortunately, most of these servicemen didn't live long enough to receive the newly granted medal, as many of my colleagues died young. After his national service, Jeff joined Hart's police, rising through the ranks, later becoming landlord of the Swan Pub in Park Street in his retirement. With his wife Carolyn, he had 5 children, 8 grandchildren, and 3 great-grandchildren, before moving to Rushton, Northamptonshire, where he lives in care. Jeff was presented with his medal by the Lord Lieutenant of Northamptonshire at Saunders Watson Nursing Home, accompanied by friends and family. And with the article is a photograph of Jeff wearing his medals, holding a photograph, I think, of his wife Caroline, and with the Lord Lieutenant holding the citation. It's a lovely photo.
Quality Street Cocktails, created by Bartender. A bespoke menu of cocktails inspired by Quality Street Confectionery has been launched at the Octagon Bar at Sopwell House in St Albans. Marrying sweet nostalgia with mixology, chocolate aficionados can sip away on a collection of 6 tipples which pay homage to the classic favours of Quality Street, from the iconic purple one to the sweet toffee penny. Available now until January the 2nd, the confectionery cocktail collection has been created by head bartender Adam Jobson, using a variety of premium spirits and liqueurs to replicate the renowned flavours. Priced at £16 each, highlights include the purple one, featuring a smooth blend of diplomatical rum, chocolate liqueur, butterscotch, frangelico and vanilla syrup, and the zesty orange cream, made with Cointreau, Grand Marnier orange liqueur, clarified chocolate liqueur and lemon. Coconut fans can look to the coconut éclair, created with chocolate cream liqueur, coconut and topped with homemade vanilla cream, whilst the lineup also includes the strawberry delight, caramel swirl and creamy toffee penny. For those who don't fancy chocolate, the bar and lounge also offer an extensive wine, spirit and cocktail list, as well as low and non-alcoholic cocktails.
Couple to revive landmark pub, the Old Fox to reopen after 8 years. A community asset, Bricketwood Pub, is set to be reopened by a local couple after being shut for over 8 years. One of Hart's quirkiest freehouses is to reopen next year after an 8-year planning dispute. The ancient Old Fox in Bricketwood shot in 2017 when it was sold, becoming a dilapidated landmark and earmarked for a new residential build. In the last few weeks, Danny and Julie Harding have decided to give something back to the community by buying the inn. The Old Fox is at the end of the mile-long cul-de-sac School Lane, which cuts through Bricketwood Common. But its remoteness attracts dog walkers, cyclists, ramblers, those on horseback, and even Morris men and clog dancers. Julie, 62, and Danny, 59, have a vision of how the pub can and will be transformed, with major refurbishment planned. Danny said, "With the right atmosphere, the right people, the right prices and a commitment to quality and service, I'm sure the business will thrive." This is an exciting opportunity to revive a village landmark that has survived generations. It's our chance to give something back to the community. The couple plan to make the Old Fox a free house, serving a range of food and run a horse tack shop in the large plot to the rear of the property. The Hardings have teamed up with Peter Dillingham, landlord of the Black Boy in Bricketwood, and the former coaching in the Saracen's Head in King's Langley, using his buying power and skills as a freehouse licensee. Danny said, "The current site is destroyed and looks like a set from a horror movie, but with hard work, expects the Old Fox to reopen in late spring or early summer." And the article is accompanied by a lovely photo of Danny and Julie Harding behind the beer pumps at the Old Fox.
more than 500 reports of flooding and fallen trees due to Storm Dara. Storm Dara resulted in more than 500 reports of flooding and fallen trees in Hertfordshire. The County Council's highways teams and fire and rescue service responded to hundreds of reports on flooding and fallen branches over the weekend, following heavy rain and strong winds from Storm Dara. Hemel Hempstead and Watford were worst hit by strong winds, with heavy rain mainly causing problems in Welwyn Garden City, Stevenage and Hitching. Councillor Phil Bibby, executive member for Highways at Hertfordshire County Council, said, "Our teams on the ground have responded brilliantly to the challenges this weekend's wet and windy weather has thrown at us. They have been working around the clock responding to calls to help keep Hertfordshire moving. I'd like to thank residents for promptly reporting issues to us over the past few days and for their ongoing patience as we continue to respond. This is a timely opportunity for us to remind them of the risks of weather like this and the precautionary steps they can take to protect their own property and stay safe and well as they move around the county. To report fallen trees or branches or flooded roads, pathways or cycleways, and to find out steps you can take to protect your own property, take a look at the website for hertfordshire.gov.uk.
This article is entitled "Councillors Agree £1.4 million to Look at Feasibility of Solar Farm Site." Council officials are to investigate a new site for a solar farm in Smallford, after surveys suggested the original site considered for the project must be protected at all costs. Hertfordshire County Council had initially earmarked the former Smallford Pit as a possible site for a proposed 22-megawatt solar farm. But on Monday, December the 2nd, a meeting of the Council's Cabinet was told that ecological habitats of extremely high value have been found there. The Council is now looking to develop the solar farm on two smaller Council-owned sites, which adjoin the original Smallford Pit site instead. Proposed solar farm is part of the County Council's commitment to become carbon neutral in its own operations by 2030. At the meeting, the Cabinet agreed to approve £1.4 million to fund works that would determine whether the solar farm would be feasible and, if so, to go through the planning process. Welcoming the move, Executive Member for the Environment, Councillor Eric Buckmaster, noted that it had been an ambition of the Council for quite some time. As well as the generation of renewable energy, he said that there was a value that the electricity generated could derive an income. Should the solar farm go ahead, the report suggests it would require a capital outlay of around £20.8 million, with a further £2.3 million required to replace the battery systems after 15 years.
Trust launches Christmas fundraiser. A Harpenden charity has launched its annual Christmas appeal, raising money to support residents in need. The Harpenden Trust's appeal runs through December, with funds collected used to help residents during the festive period, as well as to aid the charity's work throughout the next year. The charity supports young families and seniors in the town, offering assistance and a listening ear to those in need. Richard Nichols, Chair of Harpenden Trust, said, "Our Christmas appeal is the only time Harpenden Trust asks for donations, and these donations are vital to the work we do supporting residents in need over the festive period, as well as into the following year. We want to be able to help as many Harpenden residents that are in need as we can, and we wouldn't be able to do that without your amazing donations through our Christmas appeal, for which we are truly grateful." The charity is asking residents to consider Harpenden Trust as their chosen Christmas charity and to give whatever they can afford to make a difference in the community. For more information, visit theharpendentrust.org.uk.
MP officially opens new construction centre at College. a new multi-million pound construction centre has opened at Oaklands College. The new teaching facility was officially opened by Daisy Cooper MP. The 3,000 square metre state-of-the-art centre is the newest in the UK for teaching construction trades and aims to improve the student experience and enhance the quality of training and skills available. The centre on the St Albans campus includes practical learning, workshops for plumbing, electrical and renewable installation trades, and a construction lab, a virtual reality learning suite, and IT classrooms. Sustainability is a key focus for the building, with air source heat pumps and solar PV panels installed. It is also one of the first in the UK to use bricks made from fully recycled materials. St Albans MP Daisy Cooper said, "We desperately need to have a construction workforce that is built for the next 10, 15 years, and I really hope that this opening will be at the heart of that." The project was a collaboration between Oaklands College and R.G. Carter Construction, DLA Architecture and Fusion Project Management. The official launch was attended by local colleges and companies, including Morgan Sindall and RDT Architects, who provide work placements for Oakland's T-level students. Andrew Slade, principal and CEO, said, "The building has been designed to make sure we can change rooms and reflect the needs of the industry and make sure we achieve that longevity for this building. And that's vital because with technology moving at such a pace, we need to be able to adapt our space for future plumbers, electricians and engineers." Due to the new construction centre, Oaklands has been selected as one of only six colleges nationwide to partner with the Construction Industry Training Board and the Home Building Federation in their Partner a College project. This initiative will see Oaklands College students attached to house builders in the southeast area, with these companies yet to be announced.
Bespoke co-working space coming to the city centre next year. St Albans City Centre will be home to a new co-op working space in September 2025. In the fourth of its kind, the St Albans Co space will be 28,000 square feet of design-led office, co-working and meeting space. Other locations include Stevenage, Reading and Milton Keynes, with the new build said to be similar. The offices range from two-person cubicles to larger 24-person rooms, and there will be two roof terraces for workers to catch some fresh air. On-site parking will also be available for users. CEO and co-founder of CoSpace, William Stokes, said, "We are professional workspaces for professional businesses. We want people to have a bespoke space which represents them. There is a lot of opportunity in Hearts and the home counties, St Albans included." The CEO said the decision to set up in St Albans was easy, as they wished to cater for the high volume of workers in the area. "We like markets that are untapped. St Albans is affluent, on the commuter belt, and needs a premium offering that will cater for businesses in the area," he added. St Albans Victoria Street development is currently home to the Hertfordshire House and Jubilee Square residential builds.
The heading for this article is "School to Welcome Girls from September." Female students will be welcome at a Harpenden school from next year. Aldwickbury Pre-Prep and Prep School for Boys aged 4 to 13 is moving to co-education from September 25. This year, the school was named the UK's Independent Boys' School of the Year, beating 700 other educational institutions for the title. Building on this award, Aldwickbury will be welcoming girls into the pre-prep reception, year one and year two, with plans to develop further. The co-educational model will be rolled out on an annual basis so that by 2031, the school will be fully co-educational across all year groups. Headmaster Paul Symes is excited for the school to offer outstanding educational experience for boys and girls. He said, "We firmly believe that a dynamic and holistic education can achieve academic success in our beautiful setting, where children are kind, happy, and leave us as good people." Jeremy Bromfield, Chair of Governors, added, "The governors are delighted to support this decision, reflecting the preference for co-education in society, building on our current successes, and utilising our staff's expertise. We have every confidence that under the leadership of our forward-thinking headmaster, this will be an outstanding success and provide Harpenden with an independent co-educational offering."
60,000 raised for West Hearts Hospital's breast cancer appeal. Generous supporters have raised £60,000 for West Hearts Hospital's charity's breast cancer appeal. The charity is now urging the community and businesses to help them reach their first milestone of £100,000. This will fund the purchase of a Savvy Scout surgical guidance system, a technology set to revolutionise breast cancer treatment for patients. The breast cancer appeal, which is being supported by the Hearts Advertiser and its sister title, the Watford Observer, aims to raise £200,000 to fund two Savvy Scout systems. To find out more about the appeal and make a donation, go to https://raisewestharts.org.uk/appeals/beatcancer/. These devices use radar technology to detect and accurately locate cancer within a 1 millimeter range, allowing the removal of cancerous tissue. This equipment will be housed at St Albans City Hospital, serving patients from across West Hearts, including those from St Albans area. Alison Rosen, Charity CEO at West Hearts Hospital, said, "We are overwhelmed by the incredible generosity of our supporters. These donations will bring cutting-edge technology to our community and improve the care we can offer patients."
County Buses Improvement Plan gets another £11 million. Hertfordshire's Bus Service Improvement Plan is set to benefit from a further £11 million to help the services grow and development. The £11 million will accompany the £29.7 million that was previously issued and had already been allocated to improve the bus network system. New services, more frequent buses, changes to fares and ticketing, and updates to customer information points and bus shelters have been implemented. Councillor Phil Bibby, Executive Member for Highways and Transport at Hertfordshire County Council, said, "The Bus Service Improvement Plan has provided a focus on increased services, better journey times, and reliability for passengers. Improvements to the bus network also lead to more opportunities for residents who want to combine their journeys with walking or cycling. It's pleasing to see that a further £11 million of the BSIP funding has just been announced for Hertfordshire, which will allow us to continue with the developments that have been put in place over the last 3 years. We're keen to build on what we've achieved and encourage more of our residents to give bus travel a try, or make it part of their usual routine for business or leisure. Working with our partners, we remain committed to making Hertfordshire a cleaner, greener and healthier county, and public transport is at the heart of all those plans."
Successful opening weekend for new village patisserie. Redbourne has welcomed a new patisserie offering cakes and fresh coffees at the heart of the High Street. Lucy's Patisserie opened its doors at 18 High Street on Saturday, November the 30th, welcoming lovers of sweet treats. With a bi-weekly menu of hot desserts, different cakes, pastries, filled croissants and fresh juice and coffees, the eatery has plenty to offer. A successful opening Saturday saw owner Lucy Harris, 37, run out of pastries in under 2 hours. "It was mental. The Harrow Mayor came and opened the doors, and it was non-stop. I've had to bake every night since, she said. For Lucy, this has been years of hard work in the making, including taking a baking course. She said, over 5 years ago, I couldn't bake anything. I took a cake decorating course and then did 2 years as a pastry chef at West Harts College. Since her courses, the 37-year-old mother of three has traded from home and created pop-ups at festivals across the county. Her dream was always to open a shop, which became a surreal reality this year. It's been a few years of hard work, beginning with the exterior and the interior of the shop, especially since we got the keys in June, Lucy added. Now we've opened, it's very overwhelming and feels quite surreal. There was such a build-up to this point that it almost doesn't feel real. The build was a family affair, with Lucy's uncle, sister, mum Georgie, and three children supporting her all the way. It's been all hands on deck in the family. My uncle has helped with the building, and my own work, Howden's, helped with the kitchen design. The patisserie hosts 6 covers inside and a further 4 outside, in addition to a takeaway service. Lucy extended her gratitude to the warm and welcoming Redbourne community and hopes to open another branch in the future. And there are 3 pictures included in this article. One of Lucy herself, one of the cupcakes, which look lovely, and the outside of Lucy's patisserie, which is all decorated in garlands and pink and grey balloons.
Carol concert to support the homeless is the next article. A Christmas carol concert will be held to raise money to support young homeless people. The Harpenden Choral Society will be holding the concert on Tuesday, December the 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the High Street Methodist Church in Harpenden. The concert will be conducted by John Andrews, accompanied by organist Ben Collier, and will feature traditional Christmas carols for choir and audience. Seasonal refreshments will be served after the concert, and there will be a retiring collection in aid of Hearts Young Homeless. Tickets are £16 for adults and £8 for children and students. They can be purchased at Thompson's Close Cafe, Thompson's Close, Harpenden, AL5-4ES, or from tickets at harpendenchoralsociety.org.
Hospice needs your support. Rinning Grove Peace Hospice is appealing to local businesses to support its work, helping those in need this Christmas and during the coming year. Rinning Grove Peace Hospice Care is seeking local businesses to support its work this festive season and throughout the next coming year. The charity's festive corporate appeal is seeking 50 local partners to help it reach a £50,000 fundraising target by the end of the year. The money raised will be used to help the charity ensure that nobody locally has to face living with a life-limiting illness alone, especially over the festive season. Companies are being invited to make a donation of any size this month and will have the opportunity to meet with the charity in the new year to discuss working together during 2025. Support in the new year might include event sponsorship, staff volunteering, regular contributions, or team fundraising initiatives. Businesses that sign up to the appeal this month will be given a unique, branded digital Christmas card to share with their own networks and contacts to show that they are supporting vital hospice care this Christmas. Lisa Meher is the head of partnerships and philanthropy at Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care. She says, "The business community in St Albans and the surrounding area has long supported us as a charity, and local companies make a real difference with their support every day of the year. This festive season, we're keen to engage with even more local businesses of all types and sizes to explore how we can work together in the coming year. By planning to work together in the coming year, we're inviting local businesses to make a real difference right on their doorstep." Andy Kane, Managing Director of Kane Haulage in St Albans, said, As long-term partners of Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care, we are really delighted to support the charity's campaign, Funding Care This Christmas, to help our local community. For more information and to find out about supporting Rennie Grove Peace as a company, both this Christmas and into 2025, please contact the Rennie Grove Peace Corporate Team website at corporate@renniegrovepeace.org.
Changing electoral system. This is an article written by St Albans MP Daisy Cooper on how the Liberal Democrats won a vote in Parliament to change the electoral system, a symbolic victory that may lead to change. In amongst the hours of continuing budget scrutiny and debate, there was an amusing and unexpected event in Parliament. We Liberal Democrats won a vote on changing the electoral system. Sadly, this type of legislation is often simply quashed by the government, but a lapse in Labour's whipping operation inadvertently kick-started a fresh conversation about the need for a fairer voting system. The case for proportional representation is arguably stronger than ever. In the recent general election, Labour won 2/3 of seats in the House of Commons, but with only 1/3 of the votes. This is the lowest vote share ever achieved by a winning party, and so therefore the most disproportionate result ever. A poll this summer showed that members of Labour, Lib Dem, Green and Reform parties were all in favour of electoral reform. Labour members even voted for it to become party policy at their conference a couple of years ago. So when we Liberal Democrats had the chance to propose a new law, this topic seemed timely. Normally, opposition party bills don't even go to a vote, but if another MP stands up and speaks against it, a vote is triggered. For reasons unknown, a newly elected Conservative MP was put up to do just that. He claimed that the current first-past-the-post system provides simplicity and stability, a statement that was met with howls of laughter and heckling as MPs reeled off the names of the five Conservative PMs we've just had in about as many years. Labour initially didn't whip its MPs, leaving them to vote freely. But as the number turning up to vote aye with the Liberal Democrats started to pick up pace, Labour whips were seen frantically trying to persuade their colleagues not to support us. The result? A win for the Liberal Democrats by just 2 votes. The following day, the Lib Dem leader Ed Davey directly challenged the Prime Minister at Prime Minister's Questions to support the policy. The PM declined, but it's clear that Labour voters, members and many MPs do. The bill may well be debated again in the new year. The question is whether Labour allows another free vote or chooses to whip against it. Even if the victory this week turns out to be symbolic only, the fact that there was a win at all means that the drumbeat for fairer votes will only get louder.
Wedding venue plans for a new cafe. A historic Harpenden wedding venue is planning to make major extensions for a new public cafe. Currently, Rothamsted Manor plays host to fantastic weddings and private parties. Despite a public restaurant on its neighbouring research site, the manor is predominantly event hire only. Its larger event spaces include the Auditorium, Fowden Hall and the Plaza and Fowden Foyer, with capacity for hundreds of guests. In a new application to St Albans City and District Council, submitted on behalf of the venue, they wish to extend the existing premises licence. An accompanying statement reads, "The proposed application allows the public to access the spaces for general entertainment purposes, namely a cafe, to cater for users of the permissive pathways on the Rothamsted estate. The licence application includes provision of regulated entertainment, such as live and recorded music, supply of alcohol for on-premises consumption, and late-night refreshments. Rothamsted's application will allow it to continue to cater for private hire events, weddings, and ticketed events on the ground floor of the manor, gardens, and in several outbuildings.
All aboard for adaptation of beloved children's book is the headline for this article. The company of 10 will perform a spectacular production of family favourite The Railway Children at the Abbey Theatre in St Albans this Christmas. The show will run from Saturday, December the 14th to Saturday, December the 28th. The story, based on the 1905 children's novel by Edith Nesbit, follows the lives of Roberta, Peter and Phyllis Waterbury, whose lives are mysteriously disrupted when they are forced to move to the countryside with their mother. The nearby railway offers a connection to their missing father and a source of adventure. Director Maureen Bucht said, "The Railway Children is a delightful story of three youngsters who overcome the challenges of forming a new life and making new friends, having great adventures along the way. The themes that are always relevant for the Christmas season are here in abundance. Six young and eight even younger actors, framed by a strong adult cast, have given us the chance to share a warm and affirming story with each other and with you. To book tickets, visit www.abbeytheatre.org.uk or call the box office on 01727 857 861. The tickets cost £15, concessions £13, and £9 for those aged 13 and under. And together with this article is a lovely photograph of the junction box at Orchard Junction with three smiley youngsters and a smiley gentleman who I suspect plays the part of Mr. Perks.
Exploring Disability in Roman Empire. An exhibition exploring health and disability in Roman times has opened at Verulamium Museum in St Albans. Mapping an Uneven Path, which runs until Sunday, February the 23rd, looks at how Roman conceptions of health and disability compare to today. The exhibition opens during UK Disability History Month, which runs from November the 14th to December the 20th. This year's theme is Livelihood and Employment, and the exhibition examines what life was like for the citizens and subjects of the Roman Empire. Visitors can find out what good health and healthcare meant to our ancient ancestors, how they understood their bodies and minds, and their cultural perceptions and experiences of conditions we recognise as disabilities today. The exhibition is guest curated by Kyle Lewis Jordan, an archaeologist and curator with disabilities who specialises in the study of disability and antiquity. Kyle worked with a group of co-producers from the St Albans community who explore the Roman journey through the lens of varied lived experiences. The group investigated objects from daily life within the museum's collection to find connections with their own lives as disabled people today. Their historical stories of disability are featured throughout the exhibition as short films, object interpretations, and audio narratives. Kyle added, "We wanted to work with local people with their own lived experience in today's world, imagining what it would have been like in Roman times by providing historical context. The result is a very good idea of what our ancestors would have experienced." Items featured in the exhibition include rare examples of medical tools, a Roman coin depicting an empress nursing two infants, and a collyrium stamp which would have been used to treat eye infections. Stories in the exhibition are illustrated by the classicist illustrator Flora Kirk, whose previous works include a Roman Baths activity book. Alongside the exhibition, Verulamium Museum has created new accessibility options, including tactile maps and images of objects, Braille guides, ear defenders, easy read guides, large print guides, and audio descriptive guides.
Why MPs backed assisted dying bill. Daisy Cooper and Victoria Collins vote in favour. MPs Daisy Cooper and Victoria Collins have spoken after voting in favour of the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill. St Albans MP Miss Cooper and Harpenden and Berkhamsted MP Miss Collins were among the 330 ayes in support of the bill, with 275 against. It will now proceed to its next common stage. It was a second reading of the bill, which would make assisted dying legal for terminally ill adults who are expected to die within 6 months and have the mental capacity to choose how they end their lives. Speaking after the vote, Miss Cooper said, "Today's debate was very moving, with powerful and emotional arguments on both sides of the debate. I deliberated at length and grappled with the evidence and my own conscience before deciding how to vote. But I did vote for the bill today, and am pleased it will now progress for further debate and scrutiny before another final vote. Ahead of the debate, in my open letter to constituents, I set up my concerns that the bill may not adequately address issues of mental capacity and coercion. During the debate, I secured a commitment from the MP who introduced the bill that she would look at my proposal for tightening safeguards when assessing a patient's mental capacity, and I intend to pursue this. However the vote has gone, I'm accurately aware that people on the other side of the argument would have feared what this bill would have meant for them, for loved ones, and for society. The MP sponsoring the debate has run a very consultative process so far, and it is right that Parliament has agreed that at the next stage, the committee should take the unusual step for a private member's bill of accepting external evidence. I will continue to listen to constituents' views and concerns as Parliament navigates the law, ethics and safeguards around this incredibly profound issue before I decide how to vote in the final stage. Miss Collins said, "The debate on the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill was not always easy to hear. But as I listened to the debate, I was pleased that it was hugely measured and heartfelt on all sides of the House. This was a second reading of the bill, which is far from the final bill. I believe it is important to have the opportunity to scrutinise and discuss the full details of this important issue, which is why I voted in favour of the bill, to move it to the committee stage. So many local people have written sharing stories about their family members, friends, and their own considerations who are looking for dignity and choice at their end of life. The vote today will give us a chance to further discuss assisted dying, scrutinise the bill, and to hear perspectives from all sides of the argument, including concerns. Throughout this debate, I have been moved by the many messages I have received from constituents, often sharing very personal stories, and some even saying this is the first time they have written to their MP. This just shows how important an issue this is to so many people, and I remain highly grateful to everyone who has shared their perspective with me."
Christmas songs from Harding Choir. The Harding Choir will perform festive songs and carols at their annual Christmas concert, entitled Ring Out Wild Bells. The concert will be held at St John's Church, Harpenden, at 8 p.m. on Monday, December the 16th, and is the first Christmas concert under new music director Michael Veazey. During the concert, organist Richard Hills will perform an organ solo of improvised Christmas melodies. The concert also features Matthew Woodward on piano. Tickets cost £18 for general admission, £9 for students, and free for under 16s.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, December 14th. A chance to hear an omnibus edition of The Call of the Wild, a reading of the novel by Jack London set during the 1890s Klondike Gold Rush. Radio 4 Extra, 12:30 Saturday lunchtime or 6:30 p.m. In archive on 4, Victoria Wood, Loose Chippings, includes never-before-broadcast songs and stand-up linked by Victoria's personal audio diaries. Radio 4, Saturday night, 8 o'clock. Sunday, December 15th, and the castaway in Desert Island Discs is the singer Cher on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. While on Desert Island Discs Revisited, the castaway from 2007 is the late novelist Edna O'Brien. Radio 4 Extra for this one, 11 a.m. or 5 p.m. on Sunday. David Attenborough's Life Stories this week features the Kiwi on Radio 4 Extra at 11:45 a.m. or 5:45 p.m. The annual festival of Christmas around Europe features concerts from Saarbrücken, Barcelona, Prague, Copenhagen, Vilnius, Munich, Cologne, Dresden, Helsinki and Reykjavik. The celebration of festive music and singing starts at 12 noon on Radio 3 and continues till 10 o'clock on Sunday night. Bartholomew Abominations is a radical reinvention of a classic drama reflecting on narrow-minded disability discrimination and English nationalism in the early 21st century. Radio 4 for this, Sunday afternoon at 3. Brain of Britain approaches its climax with the last semi-final on Radio 4 at 4:30, while From Our Own Correspondent is on Radio 4, Sunday evening, 9:30. On to programmes then, and a broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday. Same time, same radio station, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday this week. Book of the Week is Your Face Belongs to Us, a non-fiction book by Kashmir Hill, exploring the rise of facial recognition technology and how a tiny startup created a platform that has been used for good and ill around the world. Radio 4, every day, 11:45 a.m. Will in the World, read by Toby Stevens, recreates Shakespeare's life and work and the age in which he lived. Radio 4 Extra, 8:30 a.m, 1:30 p.m. or 7:30 in the evening, each day. The fortnight of BBC Archive Works by Noel Coward continues this week with Present Laughter on Monday, Radio 4 Extra, 2:30 in the afternoon or 8:30 at night. Also, all this week, Composer of the Week is Bach at Christmas, Radio 3, 4 p.m. Monday to Friday. In the series, the essay Full Moon on Progress Street explores lesser known aspects of four hugely popular 20th century black female musicians, beginning with Ella Fitzgerald. Radio 3, every night, 9:45. And Book of Bedtime has the title Dark Tales, includes five horror short stories by Shirley Jackson. Radio 4, every night this week, 10:45. On to the individual programmes then to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, December 16th. In the series Dad Made Me Laugh, Michael Sellers records growing up with actor Peter Sellers. Radio 4 Extra, 10 a.m. or 4 p.m. In a new series of The Patch, Polly Weston visits Blackburn to discover how thousands of tons of plastic waste are piled into peaks along the canal. Radio 4, 11 o'clock Monday morning. Henneke, the comedy series starring Bill Bailey about a middle-aged man with an imaginary friend, starts a new series on Radio 4 at 2:15 in the afternoon. And the series History's Youngest Heroes this week looks at the brief reign of Lady Jane Grey, who was stripped of her crown, imprisoned in the Tower of London and forced to choose between giving up her faith or execution. Radio 4, 3:30 in the afternoon on Monday. Tuesday, December 17th, and the final Reith lecture is titled Can We Change Violent Minds? Assessing how society deals with violent offenders and asking if it's time to rethink what can be done to try and change people who have been violent. Radio 4, 9 o'clock, Tuesday morning. The first of a two-part dramatisation from 1995 of Peter Pan, starring Toya Wilcox, Ron Moody, June Whitfield and others. Radio 4 Extra, 11 a.m. or 5 p.m. And the second parts can also be heard on Wednesday. Back to Tuesday, and the drama is Finis the Brightest Falcon, the story of a Russian woman who began an online relationship with an Islamic State fighter and left everything behind as she travelled to Syria to join him. Radio 4, 2:15, Tuesday afternoon. Beyond Belief discusses the question, do animals have souls and can they go to heaven? On Radio 4 at 3:30. We're followed on Tuesday by Between the Ears, a celebration of composer and arranger Henry Mancini on Radio 4 at 4. And as it is a Tuesday, Peter White presents his regular programme, In Touch, with news and features for the blind and partially sighted, Radio 4, 8:40pm. Wednesday, December 18th, Singing in Gaza describes how, amid the rubble, children in Gaza are singing and practising instruments in sessions organised by the local branch of the Palestinian National Music Conservatory. Radio 4, Wednesday morning, 9:30. Glenn Miller, 70 Years of Mystery, explores the legacy of the superstar bandleader on Radio 4 Extra at 10am or 4pm. Christmas Past is a drama to get us in the Christmas mood, with a spooky twist and plenty of laughs to upset some of the darker elements when two pranksters target an old man who looks suspiciously like Santa Claus. Radio 4, Wednesday afternoon, 2:15. Choral Evensong this week comes from Llandaff Cathedral on Radio 3 at 3. And Mark Radcliffe presents a special seasonal edition of the folk show, described as a joyous embrace of the festive season. Radio 2, 9pm on Wednesday. Thursday, December 19th. Great Lives celebrates the life and legacy of Noel Coward on Radio 4 Extra at 10am. Severus is a drama about Libyan-born emperor Septimus Severus, who ruled the Roman Empire from Britain, even though the nation was considered a troublesome backwater that had never really been truly pacified. Radio 4, Thursday afternoon, 2:15. In This Natural Life, Martha Kearney meets cooking legend Delia Smith for a winter walk around her garden in Suffolk on Radio 4 at 3pm. While the series Mythical Creatures looks at hobs in homes across the North Yorkshire moors, examining tales of those small helpful creatures who do household chores while people are asleep. Radio 4, 9:45, Thursday night. While the podcast Today podcast with Amal Rajan and Nick Robinson is available on Radio 4 at 11pm or on BBC Sounds. Finally, Friday, December 20th, and the food programme looks at the gift of food at Christmas, exploring the work and dedication behind providing meals and distributing food to vulnerable people. Radio 4, 11 o'clock, Friday morning. The series Rare Earth presents a seasonal celebration of Britain's trees on Radio 4 just after midday. Not Even a Mouse is described as a comic sort of morality tale to warm the cockles on Radio 4 at 3:45pm. While an in-tune Christmas special, Katie Derham presents a festive edition with live performances, including the Frank Dupree Trio and the Black Dyke Band, Radio 3, 5 o'clock, Friday, December the 20th, in the evening. That's it. Thank you to Wendy for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, this is Diane from Wharfdale Talking News with Val's selection of audio-described TV programmes starting Saturday 14th of December to Friday 20th of December 2024. Starting with Saturday 14th of December, five episodes of The Simpsons start at 9:40am on Channel 4. Nick Nairn and Dougie Vipond cook up a Christmas feast in The Great Food Guys on BBC One at 11:30am. In Mr. Bean's Holiday at 11:40 on ITV1, the hapless hero wins a trip to France in a raffle. Fans of Midsummer Murders are spoilt for choice this afternoon, with four back-to-back episodes starting at 1:10 on ITV3. The late afternoon film on BBC One at 5:30 is Wallace and Gromit: The Wrong Trousers. The Oscar-winning animation sees the bumbling inventor and his faithful dog fall victim to the villainous penguin, Feathers McGraw. The last trio of couples compete to become this year's champions in Strictly Come Dancing: The Final on BBC One at 6pm. Or you might prefer to join the Crawley family as they prepare for a visit from the King and Queen in the film Downton Abbey on ITV1 at 6:05. Wildlife filmmaker Gordon Buchanan and seven huskies take on a treacherous dog sledding trail in Canada's Yukon wilderness, Snow Dogs, on BBC Two at 7:35. The documentary about the Royal Brothers concludes Edward versus George, The Windsors at War, is on Channel 4 at 8:35 p.m. Laura is called in to assist when a violent break-in leaves a man injured and his wife missing. The Diplomat is on the You and Drama channel at 9 p.m. Atticus reveals the murderer of Melissa James in the final episode of Moonflower Murders at 9:25 p.m. on BBC One. Although not audio described, George Michael fans can enjoy Wham at the BBC on BBC Two at 9:35, followed by George Michael at the BBC at 10:35. On to Sunday, 15th of December. More key politicians and public figures are interviewed in Sunday with Laura Kunzberg on BBC One at 9 a.m. Anita discovers what Christmas means to Spencer Matthews in My Life at Christmas with Anita Rani on BBC One at 10:30 a.m. A choice of films this afternoon. The James Bond Die Another Day is on ITV One at 2:40. Night at the Museum 2, the fantasy comedy sequel, is the afternoon film on BBC One at 2:50 p.m. and the comedy drama The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel is on BBC Two at 5:05. The Prince of Wales and Hannah Waddingham review the stories of previous Earthshot finalists, looking at the global picture and examining how the world can have a sustainable future. The Earthshot report is on BBC One at 5. The people who dedicate their lives to saving Asia's array of wildlife are highlighted in the final episode of the nature documentary Asia on BBC One at 7. Alan Carr and Amanda Holden introduce the annual extravaganza from the Royal Albert Hall. The Royal Variety Performance is on ITV at 8 p.m. In his outdoor shed, Jamie Oliver makes a smoked trout pate starter served with a red cabbage slaw and a huge Yorkshire pudding to share round the table. Jamie Cooks Christmas is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. Three choices at 9 tonight. Thomas Cromwell is arrested, stripped of his titles and imprisoned in the Tower of London, where he awaits trial. The final episode of Wolf Hall, The Mirror and the Light is on BBC One at 9 p.m. The documentary series about life behind bars at HMP Barlinnie concludes with a look at Glasgow Prison's role in rehabilitation. Inside Barlinnie is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. A glimpse behind the scenes to explore how the staff at John Lewis get ready for the company's busiest time of the year. John Lewis at Christmas is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. The following programmes are on BBC One, Monday to Friday. Animal Park at 10:45, Homes Under the Hammer at 11:30 and Bargain Hunt at 12:15. Escape to the Country is at 3, Monday to Thursday and 2:45 on Friday. However, some of these programmes are not shown as being audio described every day, so unfortunately it is a little bit hit and miss. Alan Carr's Epic Game Show is on ITV One at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday. Heartbeat is at 7 p.m. on ITV Three Monday to Friday. Now let's see what's on offer for Monday, 16th of December. Kirsty's Handmade Christmas continues on Channel 4 at 5:30 p.m. each evening this week. Nigella makes her beef and aubergine feta in Nigella at My Table on BBC Two at 6:30. This programme also continues at the same time each day this week. As it's Monday, it's time to put on your thinking cap as we join the quizzers in Mastermind at 7:30 and University Challenge at 8:30, both on BBC Two. The Ultimate Christmas Gift Guide with Josie Gibbon at 8 p.m. on Channel 4 could be the answer to your problems if you're struggling to find the ideal presents for friends and family. Robert Galbraith's brooding detective Cormoran Strike returns with a new case to solve with the help of business partner Robin in Strike, the Ink Black Heart on BBC One at 9. This continues tomorrow at the same time. Michelangelo sets to work on the Sistine Chapel and Raphael starts his commission to transform the Pope's private apartments. Both men determined to outdo the other and secure the favour of the pontiff. The final episode of Renaissance, The Blood and the Beauty is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Gino De Campo and Fred Syriex embark on an epic eco-friendly odyssey starting in Austria. Gino and Fred, Mission Impossible, is on ITV One at 9 p.m. Now for a two-part documentary looking at Leonardo's skills as a draftsman, engineer and painter, taking us from his rural childhood in Tuscany to the Last Supper in Milan. Leonardo da Vinci is on BBC Four at 10 p.m. Now for Tuesday, 17th of December. It's that time of year again to find out who will become BBC Sports Personality of the Year on BBC One at 7 p.m. Although not audio described, the ghosts Gabby Logan, Claire Balding and Alex Scott should give you an idea of what's going on. As winter sets in, the seals at Ravenscar Beach prepare to give birth. Yorkshire, Winter in the Wild is on Channel 5 at 7. Money-saving expert Martin Lewis is a huge fan of board games. He shares the hidden tips, tactics and strategies that help him win at Monopoly and Connect Four. Martin Lewis, How to Win at Board Games, is on ITV One at 8. Strike receives an unexpected and unwelcome visitor in the second part of Strike, the Inkback Black Heart, on BBC One at 9. Gino and Fred visit Croatia in the final part of Gino and Fred, Mission Impossible, on ITV One at 9. There are a lot of programmes this week about businesses preparing for Christmas, including the next one, which will appeal to all of us chocoholics. Discover how a three-layered cranberry treat is created in Hotel Chocolat at Christmas on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Now on to Wednesday, 18th of December. Mary is joined by some celebrity friends to create delicious foodie Christmas gifts for family and loved ones. Mary Makes Christmas is on BBC One at 8 p.m. Staff at Wood Green Pets Charity return to help their canine charges find the ideal home in time for Christmas. The Doghouse at Christmas is on Channel 4 at 8. On Christmas Eve 1850, the kindly Ebenezer Blackadder receives a visit from his loathsome ancestors, who are concerned that he's a wrong'un. Rowan Atkinson stars in Blackadder's Christmas Carol at 8 p.m. on BBC Four. Stacey is back to create a batch of homemade gifts and decorations that she hopes will bring festive joy without blowing the budget. Stacey Solomon's Crafty Christmas is at 9 p.m. on BBC One. The festive season gets off to a rocky start when the ship's resident Santa Claus falls ill and a suspicious death becomes the Christmas gift no one asked for. The drama The Good Ship Murder is on Channel 5 at 9 p.m. The unit is told to stop investigating the murder of a political activist on New Tricks on You and Drama Channel at 10 p.m. Now on to Thursday, 19th of December. Now for a look behind the scenes of Belfast's festive market, now in its 20th year, as a team of 50 create a winter wonderland in the empty grounds of Belfast City Hall. Secrets of the Christmas Market is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. D.I. Max Arnold investigates the murder of singer Chloe Carmichael, whose biggest hit, Nobody Wants to Be Alone at Christmas, reaches number one again after her death. The Chelsea Detective is on the You and Drama Channel at 8. In a special festive edition, Alison returns to Battersea Dogs and Cats Home to help more dogs find forever homes at what is always one of the busiest times of year. For the Love of Dogs with Alison Hammond at Christmas is on ITV One at 8:30. The sewing skills of four celebrities are put to the test in a festive edition of the Great British Sewing Bee Celebrity Special on BBC One at 9. The life of the comedian and writer Carolina Hearn, who died in 2016, is celebrated in this documentary from 2023. Carolina Hearn, Queen of Comedy, is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. In Kent, the local community is rocked by a string of killings committed by the so-called Whistler. Dalgleish is on Channel 5 at 9 p.m. The concluding part is tomorrow at the same time. And finally to Friday, 20th of December. D.I. McKenzie investigates when a game of lawn bowls turns to chaos when a man is killed on the green in broad daylight by an old gun that hasn't been fired in over a century. Return to Paradise is on BBC One at 8 p.m. The second batch of semi-finalists endeavour to demonstrate their initiative, quick thinking and creativity. Junior Taskmaster is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. Sister Boniface investigates when a production of Cinderella turns into a pantomime death. Sister Boniface Mysteries, Once Upon a Time, is on the U and Drama Channel at 8. Richard secures an audition and tries to track down Ken's old friend in order to invite him to a surprise party. Only Child is on BBC One at 9. As false trails are laid, it becomes evident that there are people at Larkskill with hidden agendas. The concluding episode of Dalgleish is on Channel 5 at 9 p.m. In a festive episode of the comedy set in Cork, Mairead's new arrival ends up being delivered in an unusual way. The Young Offenders is on BBC One at 9:30 p.m. In the year 2000 Christmas special, the Royals celebrate by congregating around the TV set, joined by some surprise guests, the parents of Anthony's posh girlfriend, Emma. The Royal Family at Christmas is on BBC Two at 10 p.m. We hope you find something to enjoy from this week's selection.
TNF Soundings.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Diana, and here she is.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to 10 Today, Series 2, Session Number 5. These are short 10-minute physical activity routines which will get you moving and stretching. They're great for your health, including boosting your mood. And very importantly, they're designed to support your everyday movements, your functional fitness, your flexibility, balance and mobility, such as when you have to reach up, turn, bend down and so on. These simple routines will help you with that. Just take them at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, then just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either standing up or sitting down, so just do whatever feels good for you today. When lifting your arms or knees, only go as far as is comfortable. If you have any problems with your knees or hips, take care not to twist them during the movements. It can also help to pull in your tummy when you're bending your back, and just breathe normally throughout these activities. We want you all to do these activities safely. You are responsible for monitoring how you're feeling throughout the sessions. If you feel any discomfort or pain, for example, if you feel unwell or dizzy or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. If you're remaining seated, it would be ideal if you can use a hard chair, preferably one without arms, such as a dining chair that you can sit upright in, with a straight back and with your feet flat on the floor. If you're standing, just step your feet hip-width apart, relax your shoulders and take a good strong stance. And you might want to have a sturdy chair nearby to hold on to sometimes for balance. We hope you enjoy 10 Today. So we're just going to start with a warm-up. You're just going to quickly tap or pat different parts of your body. So briefly tap along each arm, one at a time, in different places. Your upper arm, your forearm, and your wrist. Do the same on both arms. Then pat the top of both legs, just quickly tapping up and down your legs in various places towards your knees for a few seconds. You should be nicely warmed up now and ready to move. So the first exercise is catch the raise. Raise both arms straight up in the air, pushing up above your head and with your palms facing upwards. Then bring both arms down with your palms down. Now bend forwards and swing both hands together in front of your knees, a bit like a pendulum motion, from left to right and again, left to right. Then straighten up and repeat this again. So raise your arms straight up in the air with your palms up. Then lower your arms with the palms down. Bend forwards and swing your hands in front of your knees from left to right and again, left to right and straighten up. Keep going for a few more times, reaching a bit higher and sweeping a bit lower if you can. This is really good for your shoulders and arms and your balance too. The next one is look to the hills. So with the usual starting position of your feet hip-width apart and shoulders relaxed, turn your upper body to the left. Keep your feet facing forwards. Raise both arms to shoulder height, bending your elbows slightly so your hands are facing each other in front of your chest. Then pull your arms back, still at the same height, and with the elbows fully bent, like butterfly wings. Now rotate your shoulders to move your arms backwards in circular movements. If you're standing, you can bend your knees slightly at the same time. If you're sitting, you can press down through your feet. Continue rolling your shoulders to move those arms. Then stop and circle your arms in the other direction, rolling your shoulders and moving those arms forwards this time. Then stop, turn your upper body to the right and repeat on that side, rolling the shoulders and arms forwards first of all and then backwards a few more times. Try making these circles a bit wider if you can. This is great for your chest and hip rotation, as well as your shoulders. Next up, it's rise up. Start with a wider stance by moving your feet a bit further apart. Point your toes out slightly and, if you're standing, bend your knees. You can also use your arms for balance by putting them out in front of you. Keeping your feet flat on the floor, rise up a little way and lower back down again into that starting position by just bending and straightening your knees. So rise up and then lower back down. Keep going. If you're sitting, lift your bottom slightly off the chair if you can, using your arms for balance. If you can't rise from the chair, then move your feet further forwards. Press down through your feet instead and put your hands on your thighs. Just move within your capabilities. Let's do a few more. Try to go a little bit lower if you can and hold on to the rise. That's great. This is a good one for your core muscles and your balance. Now it's time for rushing water. Step your right foot forward, bending the knee slightly into a lunge position with your trailing leg naturally raised on its toes. At the same time, stretch both arms out directly in front of you at shoulder height if you can, with your hands close together. Then step back, pushing your arms out to each side in a line with your shoulders, like swimming the breaststroke. Now step forward with your left foot, bending the knee and pointing your arms out in front again. Then step back, pulling your arms back and out to each side. And repeat this a few times more, alternating your feet. So step forward, push your arms forward, step back and pull your arms back. Try to keep your arms up at shoulder level. This is another good one for your arms, shoulders, chest and core. The next one is rotating the wheels. Start by pushing both arms straight up in the air above your head, then sweep both arms clockwise together to make a big circular movement like a wheel turning. Lean forwards as your arms move past your legs, and then straighten back up as you sweep your arms up to complete the circle. Repeat this movement a few times. slowly sweeping those arms through the air, going round, down in front of your legs, and up to the other side in a big circle. Then stop and change direction to go anti-clockwise this time. So arms high above your head to start, and sweep them all the way around in a circle. Do this a few more times, trying to keep your arms straight and make a wide circle if you can. It's really good for your core muscles and your balance. Now it's time for lift the ball. Hold both arms out in front of you at chest height, with your elbows bent and your hands positioned as if you're holding a football. Then raise your arms up above your head with your hands in that same position, imagining that you're trying not to drop the ball. Now bring that imaginary ball down towards the ground, bending your knees as you lower your hands down and then straighten up again. Then repeat, starting with that ball out in front of you, stretching it up above your head, and then bringing it down towards the floor. Keep going with this for a few more times, reaching a little bit higher and a bit lower if you can. This is a great one for your shoulders, chest and core. That's good. The next one is making certain. So with the usual starting position, feet hip width apart and shoulders relaxed, step your right foot forward, bending the knees slightly, and punch out your right arm straight in front of you at the same time. Pull your arm back and step back. Then switch feet. So this time step forward on your left foot as you punch your left arm straight out. Pull your arm and step back. Keep going with this for a few more times, just alternating from left to right. You can make your punch more powerful if you can and lean into the strike. This is a good one for your legs, arms, shoulders and hip movement too. Well done. Now we're going over the sticks. If you're standing, you might want to hold on to a sturdy chair for balance. Start by lifting your right leg, bending your knee up towards your body. Return that foot to the floor and lift the other leg and down again. Just carry on with this, alternating between left and right. You can keep your arms by your sides or use them for balance if you're standing and not holding on to a chair. Try lifting each leg up a little bit higher if you can. That's great. This is good for your legs, buttocks, back and core. Now it's grasp the bird's tail. This has its origins in Tai Chi and we're aiming for a lovely flowing movement with the arms. So just start by leaning forward slightly and bending your knees if you're standing. Sweep your right arm down towards your left leg, then swing that arm back and sweep it right up into the air. Look at your fingers as they flow out. Then do the same with your left arm, swinging it down towards your right knee and then sweeping it up into the air. Keep going, sweeping one arm down towards the opposite leg and then swinging it back and up into the air. Then do the same again with the other arm. Keep those movements nice and flowing and try going a little bit lower and higher if you can. This is a great one for your hip rotation, arms, shoulders and chest. And the last one is brave the wind. You're going to do two movements together for this one. Start by holding your arms straight out to either side in line with your shoulders. At the same time, lift your heels off the floor to rise up onto your toes. Then lower your arms back down to your sides as you lower your feet back down to the floor. So raise up onto your toes as your arms go up to each side and then lower your feet as your arms come down. Repeat this a few more times, rising a little bit higher onto your toes if you can. This is good for your legs, core, and your balance too. That's all the exercises done. We're just going to finish with a quick shake to cool down. So raise both arms up above your head towards the ceiling and just briefly wave your hands and arms in the air. Then lift one leg slightly from the floor if you can. Shake it out in the air for a second or two. Raise the other leg and shake that one out too. Or you can just shake your upper body instead. So that's the end of the session. Great work, everyone. We hope you enjoyed it. Doing 10 today just 3 times a week can have positive benefits for your physical health and improve your well-being too. It's short, it's fun, and you'll simply feel better, so do keep going.
Hello, this is David, and here are some notable events which happened this week in the past. On the 15th of December 1939, the American epic historical romance film Gone with the Wind premiered in Atlanta, Georgia. The film had a troubled production, as there were difficulties casting Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh in the main roles. The first director of the film was fired, and the second director eventually resigned due to ill health. Despite the problems associated with its making, the film won 10 Oscars, is widely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time, and remains the highest-grossing film in history. On the 16th of December in 1707, scientists recorded the last confirmed eruption of Mount Fuji in Japan. Japan is located on the most geologically active part of the planet, known as the Ring of Fire. And although Mount Fuji has been dormant since 1707, it remains listed as an active volcano. On the 17th of December 1989, the first episode of The Simpsons was screened on US television. The animated show is a satirical depiction of American life and follows the everyday adventures of Homer, Marge, Bart, Lisa, and Maggie Simpson. The Simpsons, which is currently in its 36th series, has been hugely influential culturally and has received numerous awards, including 34 Emmys. Many famous guest stars have appeared in The Simpsons, including Eartha Kitt, Simon Cowell, Stephen Hawking, Gordon Ramsay, Richard Branson, and the former First Lady, Michelle Obama. On the 18th of December 2019, after weeks of discussions among legislators, the US House of Representatives voted to impeach the 45th President, Donald Trump, for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Trump became only the third president ever to be impeached, meaning he was charged with misconduct in public office, after concerns about his alleged attempts to seek foreign interference in the 2020 election. On the 13th of January 2021, President Trump was impeached again after the January 6th riot in Washington, D.C., following claims that he incited the mob to attack the U.S. Capitol building. He is the only U.S. president to have been impeached twice, a dubious honour. On the 19th of December 1997, the epic romance and disaster film Titanic was released in cinemas. The story is of the luxury ocean liner that struck an iceberg and sank in 1912, resulting in the deaths of more than 1,500 passengers and crew. The film was written, directed, and produced by James Cameron and featured Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet as members of different social classes who fall in love aboard the ship during its ill-fated maiden voyage. The film was the most expensive ever made at the time and had a production budget of $200 million. Before its release, many critics predicted that it would be a flop, but audiences proved them wrong. The film went on to become the first in history to earn more than $1 billion worldwide, and it remains incredibly popular. On the 20th of December 1946, the Globe Theatre in New York City hosted the premiere of the classic Christmas film It's a Wonderful Life. Produced and directed by Frank Capra, the film stars James Stewart as George Bailey, a man who has given up his personal dreams in order to help others in his community, and whose thoughts of suicide on Christmas Eve bring about the intervention of his guardian angel, Clarence Oddbody. Clarence shows George all the lives he has touched and what the world would be like if he had not existed. Although it was later nominated for 5 Oscars, It's a Wonderful Life initially received mixed reviews, and due to disappointing sales, Frank Capra was seen by some studios as having lost his ability to produce popular and financially successful films. The film's copyright eventually expired in 1974 following a lack of renewal, and it entered the public domain, allowing it to be broadcast without licensing or royalty fees, at which point it became a hugely popular Christmas classic. Now considered to be one of the greatest films of all time, Frank Capra and James Stewart have both revealed that It's a Wonderful Life is among their personal favourites, and Capra screened it every Christmas for his family. On the 21st of December 1913, the first crossword puzzle was published in the New York World. It was created by the editor Arthur Wynne, a Liverpudlian who had abandoned onion farming in England and emigrated to the United States to become a journalist. Initially called a word cross, a few weeks later a typographical error in the newspaper rendered the puzzle's title Crossword, and the name stuck. Early crosswords had no black squares and resembled a diamond shape, but they evolved over time to the now familiar format. The first British crossword was published in February 1922, and these versions were deemed harder than their American counterparts, especially when the Daily Telegraph later developed and published the first cryptic crossword. Readers entered a competition to see who could complete the Telegraph's cryptic crosswords in the fastest time, with 25 competitors being invited to the newspaper offices to test their speeds. The winner took just 7 minutes and 57.5 seconds and was rewarded with a cigarette lighter as a prize. Later, the top competitors were contacted secretly by the War Office, who felt their skills could be useful to the war effort as cryptographers for code-breaking work at Bletchley Park.
Hello, I'm Sue, and here are some famous people's birthdays that take place between the 15th and the 21st of December. On the 15th of December in 1970, Frankie Dettori was born. He is an Italian jockey who was based in England for a career spanning over 35 years. On the 16th of December 1775, Jane Austen was born. She was an English novelist, known primarily for her 6 major novels, which interpret, critique, and comment on the British landed gentry at the end of the 18th century. With the publication of Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Mansfield Park, and Emma, she achieved success as a published writer. On the 17th of December, in 1936, Pope Francis was born. He is the head of the Catholic Church and sovereign of the Vatican City State since 2013. On the 18th of December in 1946, Steven Spielberg was born. He is an American film director, producer, and screenwriter. He began his career in the New Hollywood era and is currently the most commercially successful director. He became a household name for directing 1970s summer blockbuster Jaws, and then directed box office successes Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, and the adventure films in the Indiana Jones series. Spielberg later explored drama in The Color Purple and Empire of the Sun. On the 19th of December, 1974, Ricky Ponting was born. He is an Australian cricket coach, commentator, and former cricketer. He is widely considered to be one of the greatest batsmen of all time, and is the most successful captain in international cricket history. On the 20th of December in 1946, Uri Geller was born. He is an Israeli-British illusionist, magician, television personality, and self-proclaimed psychic. He's also known for his trademark television performances of spoon bending and other illusions, and his career as an entertainer has spanned more than four decades. On the 21st of December, 1937, Jane Fonda was born. She is an American actress and activist. Recognized as a film icon, Fonda's work spans several genres and over six decades of film and television.
Hi, it's Clive Davis from the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. This month's recording is by Karthik, who is a resident of New Zealand. He explains the different bird calls, and there is a magical dawn chorus. It is difficult to understand that when European settlers arrived on those islands, they introduced such alien species as stoats, which decimated the local flightless bird populations. I hope that you enjoy the recording, and I also hope that you all have a very happy Christmas and New Year. I will do my best to provide you with more recordings from around the world in 2025.
Once upon a time, there was a birdland. Surrounded by the vast South Pacific Ocean, this remote country was ruled by birds. Giant moa, harsed eagles, bush wrens, laughing owls, birds of myriad forms. The dense forest and the tall mountains had no predators, and the birds had nothing to fear. So they sang. Kokako, Huia, Tui, and the bellbird all came together for a resounding dawn chorus. And this was the song of the land, since time immemorial. The land came to be known as Aotearoa, New Zealand, and its dawn chorus had a repetition. When Captain Cook's Endeavour circled the island, the crew woke up to birdsong, which they called deafening. Long before that, the Maori, the indigenous people, were mindful of the birdsong. To them, the dawn chorus was an affirmation of approach of a day, an eloquent celebration of life. But the prehistoric dawn chorus might be lost forever. Humans arrived on the island about 700 years ago, and with them came deadly predators. Rats, stoats, possums, and other introduced mammals wiped out half of the bird life. Many songbird species were decimated, and the forests fell silent. This is Karthik presenting you the story of New Zealand's dawn chorus. As a wildlife filmmaker interested in soundscapes, I was fascinated by the prehistoric birdsong of this land. The dawn chorus of present-day New Zealand is thought to be quiet in comparison to that of the pre-human era. But I wanted to explore the possibility of experiencing something that could be reminiscent of that ancient orchestra. Offshore islands that are free of predators might boast a lively dawn chorus. But on the mainland, there are only a handful of such places. Living in the South Island city of Dunedin, I didn't have to go far. Just 20 kilometers north is the Orokanui Eco Sanctuary, 300 hectares of forest guarded by a predator fence that keeps the bird eaters away. And with no mammalian predators to fear, the sanctuary is a safe haven for native birds to thrive and sing. On one spring day, I made my way to the sanctuary to listen and record the dawn chorus. The song of so many native birds coming together in a lively chorus is something I've never experienced before. And a performance like this might possibly not happen in an area with no protection from predators. Many predator control projects in New Zealand go by the tagline, "Bring back the bird song." And with the conservation efforts, I hope the native bird life and the dawn chorus throughout New Zealand becomes a little more lively each day. This work is made possible with the support of Professor Nancy Longnecker, Center for Science Communication at the University of Otago, Amanda Simon, Tahu McKenzie, and the staff of the Orokanui Eco Sanctuary.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire,
Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Though it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
Hello, I'm Andy. This article comes from Hertfordshire Life magazine, November 2018, and has the title Well in Rock. It's a masterpiece of British cinema, but it's a little-known fact that the coastal crime classic Brighton Rock was largely filmed in Hertfordshire. This article, written by Richard Luck, takes up the story on the film's 70th anniversary. Films are rarely shot where you'd imagine. Take Casablanca. The nearest Bogey and Bergman got to North Africa was a visit to Los Angeles' top Moroccan barber. Then there's St. Albans auteur Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, where the Becton Gasworks stood in for war-torn Indochina. Still closer to home, we have the Bolting Brothers' adaptation of Graham Greene's Brighton Rock. 70 years on from its release, the picture that introduced the world to Richard Attenborough has long been considered a classic. But how much of it was shot on the South Coast? Not as much as you'd imagine. Founded in 1928, Wellin Studios had played host to all manner of productions before Messrs. Bolton and Attenborough came along. Wildlife documentaries, Anthony Asquith's The Celestial City and A Cottage on Dartmoor, countless quota quickie B pictures, the facility's output couldn't have been more eclectic. Come the late 1930s, the studio, located in the heart of the town's industrial quarter on Broadwater Road, started to attract big productions and major movie names. Ralph Richardson, Margaret Lockwood, Maureen O'Hara, local girl Dinah Sheridan, even Hollywood's first Dracula, Bela Lugosi, came to the new Garden City. With Wellin, one of the few studios not to be requisitioned by the government following the outbreak of the Second World War, it continued to thrive throughout the conflict, marking itself out as a genuine threat to its heart's movie-making neighbour, Elstree. Michael Rennie, Jack Hawkins, James Mason, Michael Wilding, bona fide A-listers were so often seen around Wellin, they ceased to be remarkable. Quite how they spent their downtime, we don't know, but it's rather nice to think of Michael Denison and Dulcie Gray promenading down Parkway while Rex Harrison and Annan Eagle enjoyed a coffee in the Wellin department stores before heading back to the set of I Live in Grosvenor Square. With that picture's director, Herbert Wilcox, demonstrating how you could recreate Mayfair in the home counties, it's little wonder that John and Roy Bolting felt confident they could conjure up any number of Brighton interiors on the Wellin lot. It would certainly be a lot easier than filming on location. With their picture telling the story of a young hood, Attenborough's Pinky Brown, running amok on the South Coast, director John and producer Roy had no end of trouble placating the Brighton elders, who feared the film would inspire a copycat crime wave. Things became so problematic that the Boltings took to stealing shots on the streets of the town using hidden cameras. Similar guerrilla tactics were employed when the brothers filmed a scene at the local racetrack. Since the course had been targeted by real-life knife gangs in the 1930s, there was no way the authorities would give the filmmakers the run of the place. That the frantic nature of the shoot only added to the excitement of the sequence is one of those happy accidents that great movies seem to enjoy. In contrast, the Welling Studios shoot was positively sedate. Indeed, in the 70 years since the film came out, not a single story has emerged of trouble on the set, of egos clashing, or of the filmmakers struggling to capture their vision. Then again, it does help when your cast comprises actors as talented and professional as Hermione Baddeley, Nigel Stock, Harcourt Williams, and Doctor Who's William Hartnell, who is all but unrecognisable here as the no-good gang member Dallow. And there, at the heart of the piece, is the utterly delightful Richard Attenborough playing the thoroughly wretched Pinky Brown. Hired on the strength of his debut performance in Noel Coward's In Which We Serve, the moon-faced star doesn't look terribly threatening, but that only makes the character all the more unsettling. Attenborough's Pinky mightn't have been the first baby-faced assassin, but that description fits him very well. Impressive as the cast is, it's all but eclipsed by the behind-the-camera talent. Besides Nobel nominee Green adapting his novel in collaboration with future knight Terence Rattigan, the Boltings are as mighty a film force as has ever come out of this country. From thrillers like Brighton Rock and 7 Days to Noon, to comedies such as I'm All Right Jack and Private's Progress, the twins were as prolific as they were versatile. Brighton Rock, however, remains their masterpiece, a film so good as to be untarnished by a raft of movie rip-offs and a misfiring modern-day remake. Upon its release in 1948, the film enraged newspapers and politicians while delighting cinemagoers the length and breadth of the nation. When seen today, it's hard to believe that the relatively tame violence could have made anyone think the country was on the brink of moral collapse. Then again, a lot of things have changed over the last 7 decades. Take Welling Studios. With Elstree in the ascendant, the decision was made to shut the lot down and sell it off in 1951. Years later, Polycell took over the facility, filling the old sound stages with machinery and using the Art Deco entrance building as offices. It was different, but it still looked something like a film studio. At least it did until Polycell left town and the entire site was bulldozed. Sad as it is that Welling Studios is no more, it's wonderful so many terrific monuments to it remain. Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, Last Holiday starring Alec Guinness, Peter Ustinov's Private Angelo, all owe something to the Garden City Film Hub. And then there's Brighton Rock, a picture set on the coast, shot in Welling Garden City, and loved by everyone. Everyone, that is, except for Richard Attenborough's brother. While interviewing Sir David in 2003, I was surprised to hear that he didn't particularly care for the film or his brother's latest study of a psychopath in 10 Rillington Place. "It's very hard for me," he explained. "I love my brother very much and I've no desire to see him playing a craven murderer." Oh, and in case you're wondering which of Dickie's films David does love, Gandhi, of course, is a work of genius. And who doesn't love The Great Escape? To which the answer is nobody. Although it plays even better when seen on a double bill with Brighton Rock, a film with Welling Garden City running all the way through it.
Hello, I'm Anne, and this article is entitled Giant of the Landscape. It's written by Deborah Spring, and it's about Humphrey Repton's mission, which was to enrich the general face of the country. 2 centuries after his death, his major landscape designs, including in Hertfordshire, still captivate. Humphrey Repton began working as a landscape designer 5 years after the death of the hugely influential Lancelot Capability Brown in 1783. In his mid-30s, running short of money after dabbling unsuccessfully in occupations including textiles and farming, the son of a Suffolk excise collector finally found his vocation. His work would go on to include Woburn Abbey, Longleat, Brighton's Royal Pavilion, and London's Russell Square, and his vision can still be admired today in Hertfordshire. The University of Hertfordshire Press has marked the bicentenary of Repton's death with a lavishly illustrated volume on his Hertfordshire commissions. The book is the result of several years' hard work by members of the Hertfordshire Gardens Trust Research Group. In Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth Bennet comes across Mr. Darcy and the two Bingley sisters strolling amid the shrubbery. Invited to join them, Elizabeth exclaims, "No, no, stay where you are. You are charmingly grouped and appear to uncommon advantage. The picturesque would be spoilt by admitting the fourth." When Jane Austen moves her characters outdoors into the Regency landscape, we find such gentle vignettes parodying the vogue for the picturesque. Designing a landscape as if composing a painting became fashionable towards the end of the 18th century, and Repton, himself a skilled artist, trod a fine line between the art of landscape gardening and the robust pastoral style of his predecessor, Brown. Repton was well known in Austen's world and put in a personal appearance in Mansfield Park, where the fashion for improving the landscape is addressed directly. "Cut down an avenue? What a pity," says Fanny Price, when Mr. Rushworth suggests felling the ancient oaks on his estate, Southerton. Rushworth has been inspired by a visit to a friend's house and grounds, which Repton has transformed. In comparison, he says, "Southerton looks like a dismal old prison. I must try to do something with it, but I do not know what. I hope I shall have some good friend to help me." "Your best friend upon such an occasion," says Miss Bertram, "would be Mr. Repton, I imagine." "That's what I was thinking of. I think I had better have him at once. His terms are 5 guineas a day." Plenty of Hertfordshire landowners followed Mr. Rushworth's fictional lead and called in Repton to modernise their gardens and grounds with his signature rolling parkland with pretty clumps of trees, flower gardens, terraces, conservatories and shrubberies. The new book by the Hertfordshire Gardens Trust is an extensive study of these. Using a mix of site surveys and patient detective work in libraries and archives, the Trust's team of volunteer researchers identified 19 Repton sites in Herts, more than any other county. Among Repton's Hertfordshire commissions are 8 of major importance, including Ashridge House, Haileybury College, Panshanger, and Wall Hall. The research, to establish how far Repton's ideas were realised and how much survives of them today in the county, was directed by Professor Tom Williamson of the University of East Anglia, who is the book's co-editor, alongside former Hertfordshire archivist Sue Flood. Repton is famed for the red books he produced for clients. "When called upon for my opinion concerning the improvement of a place," he wrote, "I have generally delivered it in writing, bound in a small book containing maps and sketches to explain the alterations proposed. This is called the red book of the place, and thus my opinions have been diffused over the kingdom in nearly 200 such manuscript volumes." Beautifully bound in red Moroccan leather, they contain Repton's watercolours of the before views of a landscape, with a hinged flap to lift to reveal the proposed after. His descriptions of features and improvements are handwritten in elegant copperplate. 6 of the original books he produced for Hertfordshire clients survive. Some are held at Hertfordshire Archives and local studies in Hertford, including the red books for Panshanger and 2 in Water, sites where Repton's work can still be seen today. When the 5th Earl Cooper engaged Repton in 1799 to improve Tewin Water and his other estates in the River Mimram Valley, Repton proposed giving each estate, quote, a degree of extent and consequence, unquote, while, quote, their united lawns will, by extending through the whole valley, enrich the general face of the country, close quotes. Repton generally relied on more subtle effects than capability Brown. If Brown was a cosmetic surgeon, says Tom Williamson, Repton was a makeup artist. Repton's 30-year career crossed from the 18th into the 19th century, his style a bridge between the landscape parks of Brown to the more structured gardens of the Victorian period. By the end of his career, Repton was designing highly formal gardens, even geometric parterre, features that would have been anathema to Brown. One of his most significant late commissions, which was fully documented and illustrated in Humphrey Repton in Hertfordshire, was for a modern pleasure ground at Ash Ridge, then a private house owned by the Duke of Bridgewater in 1813. In recent years, two of the 15 gardens Repton designed for this commission, the Rose Garden and the Flower Garden, have been restored. Repton more often designed the grounds of local gentry or businessmen than the great estates of aristocrats. He was highly sensitive to the social aspirations of the moderately wealthy and their particular concern to dominate, or at least appear to dominate, the countryside around them, something he described as appropriation. He was also more aware than Brown had been of the close links between the size, role, and architectural style of a residence, its particular character, and the design of its grounds. Tom explains that these concerns need to be viewed in the context of wider contemporary changes in society and economy, especially the growing social importance and influence in the late 18th century of the local gentry and the rising numbers and increasing wealth of merchants and financiers keen to build villas with parks, often without a significant estate attached, within easy reach of the major cities. Such changes were particularly important in Hertfordshire, and especially in the south of the county, where many wealthy London businessmen bought small manors or even farmhouses and converted them into fashionable residences. Sometimes these clients did not see eye to eye with Repton about the extent of work needed, causing him to write on one occasion that if profit was his employer's only motivation, the flower garden might as well be sown with potatoes and cabbages. Good taste, he wrote loftily, can only be acquired by leisure and observation. It is not therefore to be expected in men whose time is fully employed in the more important acquirement of wealth and fame. Repton certainly worked for many such clients in Hertfordshire, impatient to have their estates improved in the latest style. In the quest for evidence for the Repton sites in the county, there have been unforgettable moments. After weeks of painstaking searches, a Hertfordshire Garden Trust researcher believed she had tracked down a missing red book to a small London museum. She made an appointment with the curator. A small red book was on the table, she remembers. It was undoubtedly a Repton red book, bound in red Moroccan leather. When I looked inside, I had a wonderful surprise. The book had not been looked at for decades or even longer, and the sketches were as bright as the day they were drawn. This book, Humphrey Repton in Hertfordshire, Documents and Landscapes, is available now from Hertfordshire University Press. And this article is accompanied by some pictures of the sketches and paintings that he would have included in his red books.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Liz, Jenny, Fiona and Anne, for reading the news, the Hearts Advertiser for providing it, Thanks to John for the radio listings, our friends at Wharfdale Talking News for the audio-described TV listings, TNF Soundings for 10 Today, and Clive Davis of the Wildlife Sound Recording Society for the fascinating sounds of New Zealand bird life.
While shepherds watch the flocks by night, seated on the ground.
David read the events in history, and Sue presented famous birthdays. Our two Hearts Life stories were read by Andy and Anne. The next programme you receive will be Mark's quarterly magazine just before Christmas, while Steve's News Extra will be the first programme of the new year. That's all from me in 2024. Do have yourselves a merry little Christmas and a very happy new year. We close with Sweet Bells by St. Agnes Fountain. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and keep well.
To you in David's town this day, is born of David's line. Saviour, who is Christ the Lord, this shall be the sign. Sweet bells, sweet chiming Christmas bells. Sweet bells, sweet chiming Christmas bells, to cheer us on a heavenly way, sweet chiming bells. The heavenly babe you there shall find, a human view displayed, all tightly wrapped in swathing. In the manger lay. Sweet bells, sweet chiming Christmas bells. Sweet bells, sweet chiming Christmas bells, to cheer us on a heavenly way, sweet chiming bells. Cheer us on a heavenly way, sweet child.